All right, well, let's see. 2 Samuel 18. 2 Samuel 18, and let's pray, and we'll jump into this and hopefully into chapter 19. Lord, it's good to be back to this part of our study. We enjoyed our couple of months or so of our Foundations of the Faith course, the class, just kind of digging into some of those topics that we don't necessarily get to hit in great detail in our Through the Bible study. And some of the discussion points, topics, subjects that we're not necessarily going to see in 2 Samuel. We're grateful to have some time set aside for that. And now as we get back into this, our cruise through your word, book by book, chapter by chapter, verse by verse by verse, help us to make sense of this as best as possible. Any lessons that we need to learn individually, personally, for our hearts, our minds, even just maybe our will, the decisions that we make and the decisions that we make that impact other people, as we'll see this evening, there's a few of those types of things. Speak to us and help us to not just, again, understand this, but be willing to apply what it is that you would speak to us. So thank you that we can be here. And again, I think we should also say, as we're about to hit the 30-year mark for us as a fellowship, thank you for your faithfulness to us in this church over the last three decades. And we look forward to next month and a proper celebration. So thank you for your goodness. Thank you for the Bible. In Jesus' name, amen. So verse 1 of chapter 18, it says, "And David numbered the people who were with him, and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them." Since it's been a little while, the quick, like, what is this? Who's what? Why is this happening? If you remember, Absalom's forces were preparing for an attack. And Absalom, of course, was David's rebellious son who had stolen the kingdom from his father, David. The correct terminology that we'd want to use would be that he usurped it. This was an illegal, a coup, basically, and this is treason. And just, again, to give us a little bit of context, to get us back up to date with this, his treason started however long before this, but I'm going to suggest that it really started to take shape at the gate to the city. You remember this in chapter 15? In fact, would you just turn back there for a second? Chapter 15 of 2 Samuel. And let me read to you the first six verses. After Absalom had come home, after this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom, verse 2, would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And so it was whenever anyone had a lawsuit, came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." And I'm sure we talked about this in chapter 15, that the gate of the city is where people would go for this type of thing. In fact, for those of us that have been to Israel and you go to some of these ancient cities and ancient archaeological discoveries, and when they unearth some of this, you'll find benches, seats, like built into the actual gates and the interior of the city there, and that's where people would go. So this person would say, "I'm from such and such a tribe." And then verse 3, Absalom would say to him, to this person and all these people, "Look, your case is good and right, but there's no deputy of the king to hear you. Moreover," Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice." And so it was whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. Like, this is just a mastery of ancient politics at that point. In this manner, please notice verse 6. This is the critical part. This is why I'm saying that the treason really started to take shape at the gate. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. And so Absalom, what? Stole the hearts of the men of Israel. And there's a few little components that went into this, and that kind of gets us up to chapter 18. But he made himself supremely important. He made himself look really important. And you notice he got up early. Like he got started with his day. Like, what are you doing today? The same old, same old. I'm trying to make sure that people recognize that I am the authority. The authority over and above what was actually placed in authority, who the actual authority was. But he decided to make himself appear to be that. And of course, you'd also notice, and you can't miss this, and this is how it still works. I mean, I'm sure we talked about this in chapter 15 when we were studying this. I would suggest that whatever percentage of church splits probably look a lot like this. Absalom then called into question the king. He called into question the authority of the king. And he also called into question the king's care for the king's people. Like, there's no one, there's no deputy, there's no one to really take care of you. Oh, if I were the judge, I'm not saying that I should be, but if I were, I would do things properly. But because right now, no one is doing that work. The one that is in charge or should be in charge, he's just not doing it. What a shame, right? And then mix in some arrogance, couched in false humility, and voila. A treasonous revolution happens as the throne is usurped. And so all the things that kind of led into that, and then you can go back and reread because there's quite a bit in the subsequent chapters. And that gets us again, chapter 18, verse 1. David numbered the people who were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. Then David, verse 2, sent out 1/3 of the people under the hand of Joab, 1/3 under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and 1/3 under the hand of Ittai, the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I also will surely go out with you by myself. I'll do this. I'll go or go with you myself. And so the king at this point wisely puts the people into place under the leadership of the right men, and David planned to go and join the fight, but the people, verse 3, answered, you shall not go out, for if we flee away, they will not care about us, nor if half of us die, will they care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us now, for you are now more help to us in the city. It's a whole other fascinating conversation, and I suppose I'm looking at Luke now. Like, maybe we'll circle around to this again in the next 2, 3, you know, whatever. But clearly they loved their king. And the people are showing wisdom. Let's say it this way in the most plain terms possible. They know what's at stake here. If the king is lost, all is lost. The kingdom essentially is lost at that point. And I think the fascinating kind of side conversation is that normally in this, boy, I'm debating now if I really want to dig into this. There's not always wisdom in listening to the opinion of everybody. At some point, a leader has to lead. At this point, though, there is supreme wisdom in him saying, you know what, people, you're right. That's what we need to do. Let's do that. And he trusts them. And they were correct. Verse 4, then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. Now the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently, please notice verse 5, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. The young man, Absalom, the guy that just took over the kingdom, please deal gently with him. Gently is an interesting word to be used in a time of combat. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. Of course, him saying this in the hearing of the people put pressure on Joab and Abishai and Ittai here to do this. If it's possible to capture Absalom, please do so. Like, deal gently with him. I don't want him just killed. So the pressure would have been everyone was aware of this, so it wasn't like 2 or 3 people heard and no one else knew it was happening. But as you look at this, it's like, wait, this doesn't make a ton of sense. This is the one Absalom, who again, with this treason, with this rebellion, with this revolt against the king, he's usurped the throne from the king. And David was not the instigator. He did not initiate any of this. In other words, David's not looking at Absalom like he's my enemy. He's my son. Though Absalom has placed David in that place of him being his enemy. And so that's why Absalom is not just content to steal the throne and everything else involved with the concubines and all this kind of stuff, but he's going after the king. We're just going to end this thing right now. So in one sense, this doesn't make a lot of sense that David would make this request. At the same time, look out over it, you're okay. David not the instigator, but what? David loves his son. And interesting, he loves his son, and as a dad at this point, he wants no harm to befall him. And perhaps this is, I'd imagine, perhaps at least part of it, maybe not greater than his love for his son, but David knows how Joab is. And not just what Joab is capable of doing, but what Joab has done. And if Joab gets his hands on that kid, it's curtains. And Joab's just going to say, this little twerp, I'm going to deal with him right now. So please deal gently with my boy. I have to tell you, this really mirrors the heart of God the Father, who, we're told in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4, desires for all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. And aren't you glad that God the Father dealt thusly with us? We who were at enmity with Him, and yet He in His grace and goodness, and I suppose we studied this last week, didn't we, in looking at what salvation is and how it works, that He would initiate this plan of redemption to bring us back to Him. He desires all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. David just wants his son alive, and we'll deal with all the other stuff later. And so, verse 6, the people went out into the field of battle against Israel, and the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside. And this is an interesting comment here. And the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. And you have to look at that and say, okay, what does that mean? Or in what way would the woods have devoured anyone? And this is where I'm going to insert some perhaps-isms, right? Perhaps they tripped and fell. More people tripped and fell. Perhaps it was thick enough that there was some cliffs or whatever and they couldn't see past it. And this is some serious perhaps here. I'm just trying to make sense of what this says. Perhaps, one commentator said, perhaps there's swamps at that time in that region. I don't know. Maybe there was. Entangled in the woods. Maybe they got so entangled that they just got stuck. Maybe they got so entangled that they got stuck and in that the woods devoured them. The people of David would come along and just, these guys are all stuck, and it just made quick work of them. Another commentator suggested this, and I think I appreciate this, that God did some supernatural fighting using natural means. He's done that kind of thing before. I'm reminded perhaps in Joshua's day of hail doing a lot of the fighting for them. Either way, there's this great slaughter. Verse 9 tells us, then Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule, which, of course, is rather odd. That would be a kingly thing, but this is not a time for kings to be riding mules. He should be riding on a horse, a steed of some variety, but this is Absalom. He's riding on this mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth, so that he was left hanging between heaven and earth, and the mule, which was under him, went on. Just kept going. The mule has no idea what's happening, right? Now a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, he's probably saying like, okay, I don't know how to tell you this. This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life, but I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree. Like this is what's happening right now. So Joab said to the man who told him, "You just saw him? And why did you not strike him there to the ground? Why didn't you kill him? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt." You can dig into the historic context of that, why that would have been so meaningful, but this, there's some kind of award here, reward for this. But the man said to Joab in verse 12, "Though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, 'Beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom.'" Like, everyone's aware of this. "Otherwise," verse 13, "I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me." If I had done this, it would have been your responsibility, Joab, to follow the king's orders and kill me. This is probably not unlike people on the, assuming this happened, on the deck of the Titanic and as it was going down, and I don't know if this actually happened, but you know, people wanting to pay off, I'll give you $1 million if you give me your seat in the life. Oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. The ship is just sinking. It's that kind of thing. All the money in the world's not going to help me if I lose my life. So Joab says to him, verse 14, "I cannot linger with you. I can't wait another moment listening to this." And he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. And 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. Okay. A little bit to kind of unpack here. Interesting with Absalom, first of all, he's riding this mule, doesn't make a lot of sense. There's the thick of the woods, and this gives us a sense of perhaps how thick it was, that he's riding along and his head gets stuck. Now, it doesn't say so specifically. There's nothing explicit about this in terms of what you'd probably expect or what you'd probably assume. Do you remember where Absalom had some kind of fame? He was known because of his head of hair. I can appreciate, whatever. So I think we're assuming that he probably got caught by his hair, though it doesn't exactly say that. But if he was he betrayed by his own vanity? It's interesting. Like, these worldly things that took precedence, even riding a mule into battle. He's just more interested in how I look than the practicality of things and the right things and these flowing locks. Perhaps that was it. But it's his undoing either way that he's stuck there. And I wonder if that's part of the way that the woods devoured more people that day. And did God allow this natural part of the battle to supernaturally work against Absalom? So coming to Joab and his disobeying of David's clear and direct orders, is this not further treason or along those lines? Disobeying the clear commandment of the king himself. He's clearly taking matters into his own hands, doing what he thought best, what he wanted to do. I know the king said this, but... And I don't think I have to pull this too sharply in one direction to wonder if there's any application in this for us. When we have the word of the king, when we have the word of the king to us that would say, do this, don't do this, and we say, well, I know the Bible says this, but I'd rather do what I'd rather do. Thank you very much. I wonder further with Joab here, because he's got to be, there's got to be different things going on in his mind to cause him to make this decision. Maybe there's something that's personal to this. Why would I say that? You remember, and kind of back it up, when Absalom finally returns home into the city of Jerusalem, he's not allowed to see dad, and he talks to Joab, hey, can I please visit my dad? No, I'll see what I can. Eventually, do you remember what Absalom does? He sets fire to Joab's barley field. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm trying to get your attention here. So is there anything personal? That seems severe to that. But I wonder if it's also personal because Joab being loyal to David, Absalom doing this to David, essentially means that David on the run from Absalom, that puts Joab's entire life into disarray too. So now my life is a mess because of what you're doing to my king. So I think there's some element of this that's personal for Joab. I have no doubt about that. But I also wonder, just again, in super practical terms, knowing how Joab seems to be as you read and you examine his life, even just a little bit, he doesn't seem to trust the wisdom of the king. Maybe the king's just being too sentimental here, but the right thing to do is we need to kill this guy and we need to do it now. Almost I'll deal with the king later, but I don't trust the king. What's fascinating about that, just on the basis of Joab's actions, perhaps not treasonous, he's not trying to take over the kingdom, but he's at least anyone that's there on the scene, and now there's these other men that are involved in this, he's openly questioning the king. This is the person that God had appointed over the land of Israel, and he's openly questioning whether he's getting it right or not. And his men nearest to him, they're now drinking the proverbial Kool-Aid too. With that, verse 16, Joab blew the trumpet and the people returned from pursuing Israel. For Joab held back the people and they took Absalom, his body, and they cast him into a very large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. And then all Israel fled, everyone to his tent. So a very unceremonious or unceremonial burial for this man. And then this little bit of commentary here in verse 18. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar or a monument for himself, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And of course, elsewhere in 1st or 2nd, I think in 2nd Samuel, we're told that he actually had 3 sons. So at this point, they must have, whenever he established his monument, he must have died. And then it says there at the end of verse 18, he called the pillar after his own name, and to this day, it's called Absalom's Monument. Joab and Absalom, very different men, but the character of them both is on display here. Again, different men, but some parallels, let's say it that way, in their decision making. I don't trust the king. I'm going to involve other people that are going to do what I think is best. Kind of going back to that as a thought, and then we'll come back to this burial in a moment here. But David Guzik, the great David Guzik, said this: we might say that Joab was correct, but not right. He was correct in understanding that it was better for David and for Israel that Absalom was dead. He was not right in disobeying King David, the God-appointed authority over him. But by David's dealings with King Saul, we see that God can deal with those in authority, and we don't need to disobey them unless commanded to by Scripture or a clear conscience. It's interesting. So was he right to do so? You can come to your own conclusions, but clearly wrong with how he went about it. So Absalom's now dead. Joab throws him into this pit, and the idea is likely simply this. Here's a man that made statues to himself in his life. And probably the last thing we, the kingdom, need is for someone to kind of create another monument, another memorial for Absalom in his death. Like, we don't need to have a glorious kind of tombstone or something. Just this guy needs to be done. No more great monuments need to be established for this man. Then from there, Ahimaaz, the son of Tzadok, said, verse 19, "Let me run now and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemy," or enemies. And here's this eager messenger. Interesting. We're told his name, Ahimaaz. And Joab, verse 20, said to him, let's read the next big chunk here, "You shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead." Then Joab said to the Cushite, "Go tell the king what you have seen." So he was an observer. He saw what happened. So the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. And Ahimaaz, the son of Tzadok, said again to Joab, "But whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite." So Joab said, "Why will you run, my son, since you have," notice the end of verse 22, "since you have no news ready?" Eager, but nothing to say. "But whatever happens," he said, "let me run." So he said to him, "Run, fine." Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate to the wall, lifted his eyes and looked, and there was a man running alone. Then the watchman cried out and told the king, and the king said, "If he's alone, there is news in his mouth. He has something to say." And he came rapidly and drew near. Then the watchman, verse 26, saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, "There's another man running alone." And the king said, "Well, he also brings news." So the watchman said, "I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Tzadok." Like it had some kind of gait in the way that he ran. Like that's got to be him. That looks like him. And the king said, "Well, he's a good man. He comes with good news." So Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, "All is well." Then he bowed himself with his face to the earth before the king and said, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king." And the king said, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" And Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant and me your servant," because he said run, so he sent me, "I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about." And the king said, "Turn aside and stand here." So he turned aside and stood still. Just then the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, "There is good news, my lord the king, for the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you." And the king said to the Cushite, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" So the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man." This is an absolute classic section in the scriptures modeling these two, not necessarily opposing things, but they can be, modeling eagerness and equipping. Eagerness and equipping. This young man, Ahimaaz, I mean, he was eager, but what was the issue? I mean, it tells us. He had no message, nothing to declare. He was not a witness of this. There is a mention that Absalom is dead, but he really doesn't know the story. The Cushite, this other unnamed individual, is equipped. But, of course, it takes longer. This news takes longer to arrive. Obviously, this is the one, though, that has a message that is ready to share. It's an interesting case study, and this would be yet another study unto itself, and maybe dig into this and read some commentaries on this. But some of the conditions, as you put this in terms of eagerness and equipping, some of the conditions or qualifications for servants within the church, this is from 1 Timothy, would be not a novice. Not a novice, and then Timothy, or Paul tells Timothy, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Timothy is also told by Paul that servants in leadership areas, capacities of the church, need to first be tested. And when you were in school, was testing your absolute favorite thing in life. You hated pop quizzes, but tests, oh man, they take time. It takes time to prep for them. And there's hours poured into studying, unless you were like me and you just didn't do a whole lot of that and your grades were going to be whatever. My older brother was this kind of guy. He, like, in high school, he took, like, all these advanced classes. And I thought, and I remember one time walking in his room, like, this is my older brother, Andy. Like, bro, what are you doing? Like, I'm studying. I'm 2 years younger than him. And this made zero sense to me whatsoever. Like, why are you studying? He said, well, if you have to be in school, then I figure you should do the best you can. And this, especially as a non-believing guy, like, this made zeros. And I'm like, okay, bro, I love you so much, but whatever. But testing, it takes time, and there has to be something in this. We're also told in 1 Timothy chapter 5 not to lay hands on anyone hastily. So Ahimaaz, seriously eager, but no message. No equipping. You have to remember that the offices or the roles within the church are given, we're told in Ephesians chapter 4, for the equipping of the saints for what? For the work of what? The work of ministry. And equipping takes time. Eagerness, that's amazing. And this is at least worth a side note mention of how many times we find this often enough. It's really in the category of praise the Lord that we see this. You know, some great celebrity, some athlete, some famous person that comes to the Lord, and we almost immediately think, man, they're going to be amazing for Jesus because what? They're famous in the world's eyes? And then almost immediately they're thrust into the limelight and they're given some great platform and there's not much for I'm kind of mixing parables and concepts, but there's not much for root, and their equipping it's not even limited, it's just not even there yet, but they're eager and other people are eager for them to share something, but they really don't have much to say. At any rate, it's a wonderful case study in how that works. Equipping takes time, even for those who are called to certain areas of, let's say, public ministry in that capacity. The calling doesn't mean that there's no need for equipping. Well, back to it. 2 Samuel chapter 18 and verse 33. Then the king was deeply moved when he discovers, of course, that his son is dead. Then he went up to the chamber over the gate. So it's right there near the gate. Everyone's around this. And he wept. And as he went, he said thus, O my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place, O Absalom, my son, my son. Again, where this is happening is at this room or something overlooking the gate there. That's relevant. And you have to understand, you have to appreciate this. I have no issue with this. He's brokenhearted over what? It's the death of his son. This is not the kind of response that, I mean, it's his son, but how many other people would say, well, he had it coming, or it's his own fault. I mean, it's too bad. And we usually say it this way when we're thinking in these terms. I mean, it's really sad, but it was his own fault. Definitely heartbreaking, but he definitely had it coming. Rather than, yeah, certainly it was his own fault, but it's really sad. I just think that we should put those buts in the right place. It's terribly sad, but it's his fault. There's just so little compassion in that. It's so wanting for any kind of weep with those who weep. Rather than, yeah, I know that he made so many decisions, but at the end of the day, this is just really so heartbreaking. So the king is just, again, look at these words here. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom. And then this, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son. And Joab, chapter 19 and verse 1, was told, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory, because of that, the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son. There are people that heard the news of that and actually heard him weeping. And because of this, verse 3, the people stole back into the city that day as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. What would be the word picture from the animal kingdom? This is like a dog with its tail between its legs. This is any of our dogs at my house when we come home on a Sunday afternoon and there's bits of plastic and you look at the dog and one of them, but it's like guilty by association. It's all this. And so this is kind of how the people are. They're just stealing back. Like, I'm just going to go to my house right now. I'm just going to go to my place right now. But the king, verse 4, he covered his face. And the king cried out with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." He cried out with a loud voice. Everyone else just, "I'm going to go home." And I wonder how many people could hear that. And then, verse 5, Joab came into the house to the king and said, "Today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and the lives of your daughters. They've saved the lives of your wives and they've saved the lives of your concubines." This is David's whole mess of a family. "And you've disgraced them in that," verse 6, "you love your enemies and hate your friends." Pause there really quickly. Is that actually so? No. But it's kind of Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated, and the idea from Jesus in basic discipleship, unless you hate these, like, wait, Jesus wants us to hate people? No, but that the love that's displayed is so far greater that it seems like hatred. This is the concept here. You love your enemies and hate your friends. The one that literally stole the kingdom from you, you are openly and loudly weeping, "Oh, my son, Absalom, my son." And the people that saved your life are feeling ashamed of what they've done in this great victory. David, what are you doing here? And then he says, Joab continues to the king, "For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well." What is he saying there? You are being utterly selfish. And here's his counsel to the king. Verse 7, "Now therefore arise, go out and speak comfort to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night." Everyone's just going to abandon you. Everyone that left home to come with you, they're going to abandon you. "And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth." What a statement. Until now. David, you can retrace your own steps, your own history, everything with Saul and everything along the way, how bad it's been for you. You've seen nothing compared to what's about to happen if you don't fix this right now, tonight. "Then the king," verse 8, "arose and sat in the gate," that's where you'd meet, "and they told all the people, saying, 'There is the king sitting in the gate.' So all the people came before the king, for everyone in Israel had fled to his tent." Interesting again from Joab. Interesting character. He's right at this moment. I mean, absolutely as right could be. And this needed to be said, and it wasn't simply for David's sake, but once again for the sake of the entire kingdom. And which is probably what Joab was thinking when he thrust Absalom through with these three swords and got his 10 guys, just let's finish the job. Stop, 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 stop. He's thinking of the kingdom. David here, it's difficult, isn't it? David's feelings, and there's no other way to say this, I'm just going to say it, his feelings were 100% valid. This is his kid. His kid just died. My kids made just so many remarkably dumb decisions, but he's still my kid, and he died today. This is absolutely valid. But here's the thing, even valid feelings can interfere with the work at hand. Feelings, even feelings of grief, and this is so important to say, it's not easy to swallow, it's not easy to process, it's certainly not easy to do. Feelings, even feelings of grief, are never meant to control us. Again, we rejoice with those who rejoice, and we weep with those who weep. Jesus, when his dear friend Lazarus died, it's the shortest verse in the Bible, he wept there in John chapter 11. He wept. And it wasn't just like, I'm not crying, wiping away a couple. He's openly weeping at the death of his friend. But David here, as valid as these feelings are, and perhaps especially because of who he was and his position, it was interfering with the work at hand. And this is difficult. It's not like feelings are an easy thing to navigate. And you wish at this point that things would just become easy for David. But from here, even though Absalom is dead and his uprising is brought to ruin, yet there was still a fairly significant amount of confusion. Notice verse 9. Now all the people were in dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, this is kind of the word on the street, the king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king? So here's the conundrum. David is this great guy, incredible history. How many wonderful things has he done for us? And he was the king. And then, of course, we forsook him to follow his treasonous son, Absalom. And that was fine for, you know, a very short amount of time. And now Absalom is dead. And I guess David should be reinstated? What are we meant to do? It's the great David, but then he lost the throne. So how does this work? Essentially, part of what their conundrum is with whom do you replace the false king who himself had replaced the true king? How does that work? And maybe the simple, and it's not even elegant, but just the simple application might be that it's best to keep the true king in his rightful place from the start. If we can avoid placing false kings on the throne of our hearts, we'll have to make fewer decisions like this. Let's just keep Jesus central, and things actually get a little bit easier in these regards. Well, from there, this appeal to the elders of David's tribe begins from David, verse 11. So King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel, all the other tribes, have come to the king to his very house? Verse 12, you're my brethren, you're my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king? So they're dragging their feet for whatever reason. And then he also says in verse 13, and say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. So he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man. So they sent this word to the king, return, you and all your servants. Then the king returned and came to the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go and meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. For whatever reason, again, they're dragging their feet, but I do appreciate this from David. He doesn't force himself, does he? He doesn't force his reign. He doesn't force his authority. They needed to decide for themselves to submit to the king's rule over them, his authority and lordship over them. He's not forcing it at that point. Now, this is an interesting side note here, as he mentions about Amasa or Amasa. Would you turn back to chapter 17 for just a moment? Chapter 17 and verse 25. As David had gone to Mahanaim, Absalom crossed over the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel, and verse 25, chapter 17, 2 Samuel, and Absalom made Amasa captain over the army instead of Joab. This Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Yitra, an Israelite, who had gone into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, the sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. Wait, Amasa? I'm going to put that guy over Joab? Because Joab's Joab. And at some point, he can't keep doing all these things that he's doing. Sometimes he's like right and you really appreciate it. Even later on, he's offered some wonderful counsel to the king. But that dude who went with Absalom, I think I can only put this into one word. This is what we might call grace. Did Amasa deserve any of that? No. But David extends this grace to him. Really fascinating. Then, verse 15, the king returned and came to the Jordan. And I already read this. Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. And Shimei, do you remember this guy, the son of Gera, a Benjamite who was from Bahurim, he hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. So he's approaching the king. That's important. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. And they went over the Jordan before the king. And then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, he fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. And then he said to the king, so he's approaching the king, "Do not let my Lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my Lord the king left Jerusalem, for the king, that the king should take it to heart." Shimei continues, "For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my Lord the king." After he finishes this, Abishai, the son of Zariah, of course this would be Joab's brother, answered and said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" And David said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zariah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel?" Like, I don't need to prove anything. "Therefore the king said to Shimei, 'You shall not die.' And the king swore to him." Wait, so who's this guy, Shimei? You remember the guy, Shimei, from chapter 16? When David's leaving, like, "We got to get out of Jerusalem quick. Here's Absalom. We got to go right now, O king." And Shimei is the guy that's throwing rocks at the king and cursing these, just openly yelling, and I'm sure it was likely Joab, I'm not sure, but it's those kinds of, "I just go kill him right now. Well, maybe the Lord sent him because maybe I've done something wrong, so no, just," and he tolerates rocks, and so he's kicking dust at him. Like, that's in baseball, that's the worst insult if an umpire gets the call wrong and just kick dust at him. This is not a baseball thing. But so this guy comes and, in a word, does what? He repents. And David, as a good king, shows mercy. There's actual humility here from Shimei. After a public scene, he repents publicly. And he says it, and this is what we read. He's the first to arrive there. And he uses this language, "I have sinned." It's not David says, "Get that guy over here, I want to have a conversation." He instigates the conversation. "I have sinned." And I love that, because David extends this mercy to a man who, in this humility, in this recognition that he's wrong, he's not trying to paint this in a different light. It's not, "Well, you know, at the time, O king, you could understand why I was acting the way I was acting, and, you know, it would seem appropriate for this." No, "I've sinned. I've done wrong, and please don't hold this against me." He's asking for mercy, and David extends mercy. Now, Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Let's read this whole chunk. "He had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. And so it was, verse 25, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king, David, said to him, "Why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, 'I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame.' And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. And therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king?" And so the king said to him, to Mephibosheth, "Why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, 'You and Ziba divide the land.'" Then Mephibosheth said to the king, "Rather, let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house." Mephibosheth, you might remember him. This was the man, Jonathan's son, also known as Saul's grandson. He was lame in his feet from a fall, and he had received such mercy and grace and blessing from King David that he would eat at the king's, as he mentions here, eat at the king's table always, but not just always, not just at the king's table, not just at the table, not just, you know, in the same room, not just adjacent or near that, at my table. Do you remember what else David said to Mephibosheth, the promise that he made to him? "As one of my sons. The way my sons sit at my table and eat with me, so will you." And then he's deceived, and he wasn't there with David in this retreat from Absalom. And this deception then gets him to this point, standing before the king, and kind of, now what? And there was Ziba, the servant, they had, you know, he was supposed to take care of Mephibosheth's household and all of those types of things. And yet now, standing there, personal wealth was no match compared to relationship with the king being restored. Ziba can have it all. He can have it, king. He can have it. Inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. That's enough for me. I love that in verse 30. All that he has, he can have it. He can have it. And it's a challenge in so many ways. Again, if we're looking for any application in this, compared to our relationship with the king, what is material wealth and material goods? Secondary at best. I'll tell you what, there's a little bit more to be found in this chapter, and it's quite a long chapter. So let's call it good right there. We'll pick it up in verse 31. Next week, there's a few other lessons to be learned from a couple other individuals and some good stuff there. So Lord, thank you again for your word and any lessons we might need to learn from any of this. And this, once again, a difficult chapter and a couple of chapters, of course, but a time in David's life and some of the things that happened to him and some of the grief that he endured and needing to hear some of those tough things from Joab. We wish, Lord, I think all of us can agree with this, we just wish that there be some reprieve from pain. We wish that, can't we just get a break? It's so difficult. And we look at the state of affairs in our own nation and how divided it is, how lost the people around us are. It's difficult. But may we be the type of people like David that would mourn for those that are lost. Yes, we hunger for your justice, and in your good time, it will happen. In the meantime, while mercy is available, while grace is available, Lord, that we would be more interested in telling people that news, letting people know about you and your kingdom, about your grace, your goodness, your mercy, and your love. Help us with these things, Lord. So thank you for your word. Thank you for another Wednesday evening. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks for being here. Good night. Hope to see you Sunday.